Hello, you're listening to Playback Daily on Tuesday, the 4th of June. I'm Louise Herity, and here's some of what's coming up.
And I gave Joey a belt beside me and said, I don't believe it, I'm actually raging, because it will look like I've somehow plagiarised the film. But a lot of people thought The Banshees of Inisherin was a little bit fantastical, and
no.
But I didn't at all. I really, really related to it.
Nothing else has been invented or discovered that has improved the quality of human life as much as antibiotics. And it's a warning to us, because at this stage, 100 years later, right, we see the worrying effects of antibiotic resistance.
I'm so proud of my teammates as well. It's to qualify 10 athletes out of 13 possible, and it could have been, the other three could have got over the line as well. So I'm so proud. I'm so proud to be Irish as well.
Well, over the next few weeks, physicist Dr. Shane Bergen will join Claire Byrne to discuss experiments that revolutionised science. And the feature kicked off today with experiments that didn't go to plan, but that led to great things.
Lovely to have you back with us. So will you explain to us what role experiments play in science, firstly?
Absolutely. So I work with science students in UCD year in, year out, and we just come to the end of a busy academic year. And one of the questions I ask them at the very beginning of their science degree is, what makes science science? And for some reason, they all think it's about curiosity or creativity or asking questions. And that's true. But it can come as a bit of a shock to them that our colleagues in history or philosophy or politics, all those other places, they ask questions too. So what makes science science? Essentially, it's experiments. So we form hypotheses, which is just an idea about how something in the world might work. And then we have to go and run experiments.
Based in fact, though, your hypotheses will be based in fact. Isn't that how it works?
It's normally building on previous work.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, so you would rarely get something that's completely out there. Now, there's nothing to say that you couldn't go and do something out there. But the trustworthiness of science, the essence of science, comes down to data that's collected through experiment. And so you can have all the ideas you want, but it's not science until you can show data that's been collected through an experiment that's verified. And once you, like, the next step in the process is you do your experiment, you say, oh, this shows my idea was right. And you have to convince your peers that they believe that you're right too. And that's when it becomes sort of accepted wisdom. So all the stuff you get in your science textbook in school is all grounded on experiment. But I think learning lots of facts and figures off is essentially not science. The essence of science is doing experiments. And so I think kids in school should be just do science to learn science.
Okay. Well, now we're going to talk about some of those experiments that maybe didn't quite go to plan, but threw up some really interesting results. So tell us about the pigeon poo and the echoes from the dawn of time.
Absolutely. what a random picture to paint, but it's true. So for a long time, we didn't know how the universe started, right? Now, we know today about something called the Big Bang, right? Mm-hmm. Which was that billions of years ago, the universe started, okay? But there was a lot of debate going on, a lot of ideas being thrown around in the early 20th century. There were two big camps. One was called the steady state camp, which is basically the universe just exists. It's not getting bigger. It's not getting smaller. The other one was that the universe grew from a singular point, at the Big Bang. So it started and has been expanding with time. But there was no experimental evidence to show which was right. And there were a couple of what we call theoretical physicists. These are people that come up with the ideas. They had thought about the expanding universe and were thinking of experiments you could do to test their idea, but they hadn't been able to actually get on and do them. Meanwhile, right, this is all in America, a couple of miles down the road, there were two scientists working with something called a radio telescope, a big dish, and they were doing something entirely different. They were looking at something entirely different in space, and they were trying to get their radio telescope to work properly. And as any scientist will tell you, it's really important when you're doing an experiment that you can distinguish an actual signal from noise, right? So noise is just the static that goes on in the background. And they couldn't get their radio telescope to give a clean signal. And at one point in the journey, they actually figured that pigeons pooing on the surface of the telescope was causing the static. Another one was the hum of radio stations from New York might be causing the static. And they worked hard and hard and hard. They couldn't get rid of the noise. And it was only when they all went to a conference, these two random camps, that the pigeon poo guys were talking to the Big Bang people, and they realized maybe you're actually detecting a signal from the Big Bang. It turns out they were. It turns out they were measuring something called the cosmic background radiation. So it's a hiss that comes from the origin of the Big Bang, and you can actually still measure it today.
So how did they rule out the pigeon poo?
So they basically would have cleaned it and as much as possible and looked at what the telescope was doing, and they also then would have let it got dirty and measure like from pigeon poo and see was there a difference. They found there was no difference.
But they were still getting the same sound feedback.
Exactly. So, but they were able to show, and they all got the Nobel Prize for this, that they had accidentally discovered evidence for the origins of the universe.
Now, another one which is really interesting is the X-ray. Mm. And they were the unexpected side effect of an experiment on something completely different.
Yeah. So at the end of the 19th century, scientists had discovered something called the electron. That we know this now as the grounding for electronics, right? But this was completely revolutionary. And when they discovered it, a guy called J.J. Thomson, no idea as to what it might be useful for, but it was interesting to them because they were scientists. So they were doing this by building something like a bulb, right? And it produced these things called cathode rays. And it glowed. It was like a neon sign. And scientists would go and do these kind of shows for the public, showing them these rays of electrons. Enter a guy called Röntgen, a German scientist, and he was interested in how these rays of electrons might pass through different materials like glass, for example. And so he set up this cathode ray tube, right? It glowed, it was giving off electrons, and he was putting pieces of glass between it and a screen. And when he did that, he noticed, he put his hand into the ray and he could see on the screen the bones within his hand. Now, to say that this would have been a surprise is a massive understatement. To that point, no one had ever been able to see inside the human body without cutting it open. He had discovered something called the X-ray. Again, had no idea as to what it might be useful for, but it perhaps is one of those things that revolutionised medicine in a way that nothing else has done.
And he didn't know, of course, what kind of harm he might be doing to himself because of the radiation.
Absolutely none. And I remember visiting Berlin a couple of years back and going into their science museum. This is the kind of thing I do on my holidays. And you can see the original X-ray. His hand and his wedding ring is evident in it.
Yeah, and you can find that online as well, can't
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. So him and his wife were playing with these things. As you said, they had no idea as to the harmful radiation of an X-ray. But of course, it's a balance between the capacity to see into the human body, but also the harm from the X-ray mm-hmm. itself.
So you mentioned holidays there, and our next one now brings us to the importance of taking holidays and the link to a holiday and antibiotics.
Absolutely. I'm just back from a holiday myself. So I'm just wondering what scientific curiosities await when I get back to UCD. But I'd point to the work of Alexander Fleming in this area, famous for discovering something called the antibiotic, which we'll all have taken. So Fleming went away in his holidays and he left a petri dish with a bacteria in it. And he imagined when he came back from his holidays, the bacteria was going to have grown and grown and grown, as they do when they're left in petri dishes. Mm-hmm. The petri dish is basically a steady food source for the bacteria. So he imagined this thing would just get bigger and bigger when he was on his holidays. And he was surprised when he opened it. The legend is he was almost about to throw it in the bin, is that the bacteria hadn't grown in areas where there was a mold in the petri dish. He had discovered that mold was actually an antibiotic.
So it had prevented the growth of the bacteria.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, he had been interested in the area from the times of the First World War, where he was using things called antiseptics to try and treat bacterial infections. But he got nowhere with it. So it was completely accidental that he discovered what the term he termed it, antibiotic. But he didn't have the money to do anything about it.
But he knew what he had discovered,
he
didn't
did,
he?
But he didn't have the resource, right? He didn't have the resource to be able to follow that idea. Separately then, governments got involved and they funded massive research into the development of antibiotics. And I'd say perhaps with the exception of vaccines and a couple of alterations to food sources, nothing else has been invented or discovered that has improved the quality of human life as much as antibiotics. And it's a warning to us because at this stage, 100 years later, right, we see the worrying effects of antibiotic resistance. And we can, I think that none of us could even imagine what it would be like to go and cut your leg on a piece of barbed wire, right, running around a farm, and that could eventually kill you.
Yeah.
And so that an antibiotic was able to transform healthcare in a massive way. So these are precious materials.
Aren't we lucky he didn't throw it in the bin when he got back off his holidays tidying up the desk. Now, research during the war then led to super glue.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and it's interesting, we often think war leads to innovation. It does, right? But the reason is that governments invest massively in science and research to give them an edge. There's nothing to say that governments who would invest in science and research in peacetime wouldn't get the same results. But we go to this chap who was looking to create transparent gun sights during the war. So you look through these sights to see your enemy so you can fire at them. And he was using a range of materials and he came across one and he was like, oh, this has potential, but it's very, very sticky. So he put it aside and
that's not what I'm looking for.
Yeah,
right,
not
now.
What I'm looking for. But perhaps him being the clever, I'll get the name for you here. It's my old chemistry teacher be angry if I didn't read it out. It's a cyanoacrylate, right? That's the name of the chemical. We know that today as superglue. So he had discovered superglue. He had put it aside because it wasn't what he was looking for. But he realised years later there was something in it, and that led to the product we would call superglue.
So he went back to his old experiment and said, I'll have another look at this sticky stuff that was useless for what I needed it for at the
exactly.
time,
yeah.
but transformative in another way.
Ideas have their day, particularly if you're clever enough to join the dots.
And that was Dr. Shane Bergen on Today with Claire Byrne. A young goat that was stuck on top of a 100-foot castle tower in County Donegal has been rescued. Rachel English had more on Morning Ireland.
The female goat spent 4 days on top of the tower in Greencastle on the Inishowen Peninsula. Kevin McGinley, Superintendent Inspector with the Irish Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, brought the goat to safety. He's on the line. Kevin, thanks for talking to us. How did you come to hear about this poor goat?
Good morning, Rachel. Yes, I suppose the background to the call was that the ISPCA had been alerted to the situation as far back as last Friday. I monitored the situation throughout the weekend, Rachel, and having spoken to locals and keeping an eye on social media, there was a social media page set up in the local area for people, asking people to do whatever they could to attend the plight of the goat. So as I said, I was monitoring the situation over the weekend, and just yesterday morning, Sunday, I decided to attend the scene and assess the situation to see what help the ISPCA could provide.
I've seen a picture of her perched up on top of the tower. She was a very long way up. When did you decide that you'd have to scale the tower?
Well, I had been aware, you know, that the goat had been up there for a few days prior to me arriving there even. So, you know, I know locals had improvised. One gentleman had actually climbed the tower himself as well prior to that. But it's a very, very difficult ascent when you're climbing up through the tower. It's a sort of a circular format inside the tower, and it goes around in a circular movement. Halfway up, the steps or the stones halfway up had been collapsed, which made it even more difficult. This gentleman, as I said, had improvised and put a set of ladders there and placed two planks of timber on the ladders in the hope that the goat might make its way down itself. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. So as I said, when I arrived there yesterday, I assessed the situation and made the decision to climb the tower myself.
Mm-hmm. And why would she have gone up, do you think? Would it be just to get a bite to eat, or what would make her do that?
Goats are notoriously good climbers. They're very, very curious. They're very they get into situations where they really, really shouldn't. I don't know what the background or why the goat ended up there, to be quite honest with you. All I do know is that the goat had been there for several days, and it was becoming increasingly clear, you know, that the goat wasn't going to come down of its own accord and would require assistance.
So how did you get her down again? You had to scale the tower.
I got up to the top of the tower by climbing the circular staircase, for the want of a better word, inside the tower, and I was able to contain the goat there and bring her back down to the back down to the ground below. Unfortunately, when I was up there, I established very, very quickly that the goat had sustained an injury. And that became, you know, it became more increasingly concerning for me from that point of view. I was more concerned with how bad the injury was to the goat's leg. And, you know, I formed the view that the goat would need immediate veterinary assistance. And that was first and foremost in my mind.
It can't have been easy to get her back down again, though, was it?
Certainly not. It wouldn't have been an adult goat now, Rachel. It would have been a young goat, a kid goat, just a bit above a kid goat, maybe around 8 months old, weighing about 20 kilos. So from that point of view, it wasn't that heavy or whatever the case may be, you know. But just so thankful to have the goat back down to the ground level. And I immediately transferred the goat to a local veterinary practice, where it became clear that the goat had, in fact, sustained a fractured leg. The goat had received immediate long-term actin pain relief from the vet. A cast was applied, and the goat will have the cast on its leg for approximately 6 weeks going forward. It will have to be, it will be in the care of the ASPCA, obviously, and it will have to be very restricted in terms of its movement and its mobility for the next 6 weeks. But the vet is very, very confident that the goat should make a full recovery.
All right, so she should be okay. That's good news. Does she have a home, do you know?
Not just yet. Not just yet. I'm following up on a number of queries. There is talk locally there that there might be an owner for the goat. So the work starts today, Rachel, to be honest with you, to ascertain, is there an owner for this goat? And obviously we need to speak to the owner in relation to that. If not, the ASPCA will carefully, you know, monitor whatever applications come in to rehome the goat going forward. And we'll obviously get the goat into a good environment.
Kevin McGinley from the ISPCA chatting to Rachel English on Morning Ireland. Kilkenny author Orla Mackay has just released her debut novel, Mouthing, and she joined Maura Duran, who was in for Oliver Callan today.
Orla, I can't believe this is your first book.
Well, that's great. Thanks a million. It's accidental almost. So I'm delighted that it's getting such a lovely warm reception and so much coverage. It's a little bit overwhelming, but also fantastic. Yeah.
You know what it is? It's a very different book. And just for people listening, give us a synopsis of it.
Okay, so it's based on a rural village in Ireland. It takes a place that from a distance seems completely insignificant, just a little dot on the map, but it's hugely important to the people who live there. And it plays with this idea that there are three sides to every story. So each story is told from three different points of view. And if I was just to give you a flavour of some of the characters, two of my favourites are Mona and Joe. And they're a brother and sister. We meet them at a point in the novel where their tyrant of a father has just died. And Mona is so tired of being controlled that she takes the parish priest hostage, but in a very Irish way. So there are no AK-47s or blindfolds involved. She does something much more serious. She takes control of his heating and she steals money from mass cards and she hides his medication and sells anything that isn't nailed down. She puts it up on the buy and sell. So then there's Joe, her brother, who becomes so lonely as a result of Mona living with the parish priest that he takes a cow into his living room for company.
I know, it sounds kind of weird, right? But I have to just, I'm going to pull back. Because I handed you my copy of the book, which
you
have to say now, I don't even want to let it out of my paw. But I'm going to bring you back to the first page of the book. And this is the family we're talking about, the Muldownies. We start with them. Can you read a little bit for
sure,
people?
Sure, I'd be delighted. Thanks a million. So this is Mona Muldowney, 1963. It was a summer's day. We were sent for cabbage. Two heads of it. Down the road to Jack Costigan's. Tidy rows of vegetables ribbed Jack's garden. Worry tangled our minds. I don't think she really needed the cabbage, Mammy. Not as a matter of urgency. But she didn't need us either, listening behind doors, trying to make sense of the hush that had fallen on the house. We were set to work after the long walk back from Jack's. Knowing not to ask questions, we peeled and buttered, sliced and rolled. The tarts came out lovely, happy with that. And the pavlova rose to a great height, lifted. But that wasn't enough to take it away. The silence, the sadness, if that's what you'd call it.
Right, give me the book back now before you try and steal it on me. Now that, for me, set up the whole story. Because I'm from the country, I'm from the Aran Islands. And did you grow up in the country?
I did. I'm from a small village in North Kilkenny called Gathabone. And it's a place like Ballyroan, but it's Ballyroan is completely fictional. But it's a place that's hugely important to me. And I really identify with John McGahern, who said that the local is universal, because there's often this idea that the big stuff of life only happens in cities or towns. But wherever we find people, we find a commonality of experience, and there'll always be grief and loneliness and loss and stigma. And my idea in writing this book was to create a village that represented all villages across Ireland.
And as Brendan Kennelly said, if life in little places dies, greater places share the loss. And you've got that at the beginning of your book as well. And that is so true. But getting back to the Muldowney family. So that's the beginning. The father dies. The guy you were telling us was the tyrant. But the way this is written. So the first chapter is written in such short sentences, some one word sentences. And is that to convey the kind of nervousness and chaos that is happening at that time, or the shock almost they're in as a family when the patriarch passes?
I like that idea, but really what I was trying to do when I was writing this was to capture the real life rhythms of the language of rural Ireland. And I think that's often lost, and we have this tendency at the moment to speak in transatlantic accents, and I wanted to capture something that's almost endangered, really.
Yeah, like Crater, C-R-A-Y-T-U-R-E. You see, one of the lads upstairs is not from the country like us two, right? And he read this, the book as well, and he didn't relate to it the same way I related to it, because the nuances that you talk about in the book that are such part of everyday life in the country, a city slicker finds that hard to kind of grasp, especially something like a funeral. Like in the book, the mother here, Mrs. Muldowney, she washes the father's teeth about a million times, and they're not real teeth. They're actually his false teeth. And then before she puts them into him in the coffin.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned funerals, because funerals are such a big deal where I come from, and they're done so well. And unfortunately, we had a loss in our family recently. But it's the most beautiful thing when you see such a show of support from
and send off.
Yes, and such a great send off. And the amount of comfort that comes from that is amazing. And I suppose as a result of seeing so many funerals and seeing them being done so beautifully, this is something that I've kind of taken inwards and brought into the book.
You certainly did. And you paint the great pictures, and that is, you know, the best thing as a writer can do. Sometimes flowery language for me is lost on me sometimes when I'm reading, that it's surplus to demand in my own. That's just me now. But I just want people to paint pictures in my mind, and you have with this. As we go on through the book, and as we, as you said, see the characters from so many different perspectives, Joe, the brother of Mona, as you mentioned there, takes the cow into the house. It reminded me of the Banshees of Inisherin, where Colin Farrell took the horse into the house.
That's gas, because I went to see the Banshees of Inisherin with my best friend Joey. And when we were watching it in the cinema, my book had been taken on and was well in the process.
You had written it first.
I had written it first, and I gave Joey a belt beside me and said, I don't believe it, I'm actually raging, because it will look like I've somehow plagiarised the film. But and a lot of people thought the Banshees of Inisherin was a little bit fantastical, and
no,
but I didn't at all. I really, really related to it, and I really enjoyed it.
No, yeah. You're right, and I was the same. But the idea as well, if you talk about the Banshees of Inisherin as well, that it depicted, you know, mental health, sadness, depression in rural Ireland, and when Joe in your book took the cow into the house, he did it for a reason.
Yeah, and like that, I think it seems very unrealistic to begin with.
You can open the water there.
Thank you. Yeah. But I think the stories are told with sympathy, because I really felt sympathy towards the characters. And I hope that comes across. And I hope that people feel that it's an honest and realistic depiction of life in rural Ireland, and I hope they feel it's respectful as well at the same time.
Yeah, but you know what I think is funny as well? We're talking here and we're all wholesome and, you know, talking about funerals and everything, which is so true. But there's also loads of dark humour in this book. Like, seriously, when you are describing that Joe took the door off the house to let the cow in and she wouldn't come in first and all, I mean, it's just, it's laugh out loud stuff.
Well,
you
I'm
obviously
delighted.
Have a bit of dark humour in your head to write this.
Yeah, I think Irish people are naturally really funny. And I think if you look around any pub and you see people are so engaged and so having such a great time and laughing at each other, I think it's really hard to go to comedy shows. Personally, I have no time for sitting down and paying to be entertained because I find the people around me are so funny, my family and my friends. And often people from the outside might be a little bit shocked at our interactions, particularly people from other countries. And they see that the way we communicate is with affectionate put downs and slagging.
Yeah, that's true.
But there's more love in that than there is in, you know, this full on professions of undying love. So
You're right. And that kind of soliloquy is almost, I love parts where you say stuff like, it drove him queer, that I wasn't paying a blind eye or picking notice on him. It's just so funny, you know, when you read all these things, it just brings me back. But as we move through the book, because you start in the 1960s and it brings us up to the 2000s.
That's right. Yeah. So the book spans about 60 years. Yeah, and it goes from the early 60s up to the 2000s. It just follows the ordinary goings on in the village, the disagreements that the locals get tangled up in and the way their lives pan out.
Mm. You deal with a lot of issues, though, in a funny manner. But sometimes, you know, it's very sad as well. Closeted nuns, unmarried mothers, alcoholic aunts. And that brings me to Kate. I loved that character, Kate.
Thank you. Kate is... Yeah, she's quite a character, all right. And
Kate Kelly.
She's probably one of the more unsympathetic and harder characters.
Oh, she's a total biatch, isn't she? She's horrible.
She is.
So yeah. Her niece gets pregnant and she goes, without giving the whole book away, to America, to New York, to stay with Kate. Now, Kate has a lot of issues, but they're all going back to the past.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot of inherited trauma in the book. And what I was doing was I was presenting female characters from different generations and trying to tackle the problems that women have been facing from the dawn of time. So we have the unplanned pregnancy and falling for an older man. We have being the other woman and the loss of a spouse with Anne Trehy and the loss of a child with a more minor character in the book. And so it's not that the theme of female empowerment was a driver. It's more that I was trying to represent all villages across Ireland. And I couldn't do that without representing these issues. But I also, three of the four stories have the male voice. And I think that's important because I feel the male voice is very often lost and I wanted to represent that as well.
Do you? In what way?
Well, I just think, particularly when you think of the stories of mother and baby homes in Ireland, I'm absolutely fascinated at the fact that it has received, rightly so much coverage. But I've never heard from a man whose partner or girlfriend has gone into the home and that they are at the loss of that person and their child as well. I think that perspective must be so interesting because it's not that men are so unfeeling that they don't care to be involved, but they're lost and invisible in the whole story.
Yeah, and that's actually very true because you don't often hear that. Mm. And I suppose oftentimes the man, A, didn't know, or B, wasn't allowed to find out.
Yeah.
So they had to suffer that loss in silence because they didn't go through anything physically.
But surely after the fact, they knew and felt something.
Like Mattie, even when you think about how she left him in the book and went off to the States. Yeah, that's very true. That's another side of things that you don't think of. I think also when you look at mental health and how years ago it was the mental home, you know, the psychiatric home that Joe Muldowney and his sister Mona ended up in. And really it was all to do with the father. And this inherent trauma through the generations. I think that's a theme throughout your book.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of lonely people in the novel and they're all lonely in different ways. And some people might think that tight-knit communities like Ballyroan could be an antidote to loneliness. Mm. And there's definitely a strong feeling of shared responsibility and mutual support that can help people to feel more connected and more engaged when they're from a small village. But at the same time, I don't know if there's a cure for that chronic loneliness that Joe suffers, for example. Mm. And I think the reason I deal with loneliness so much is because I think a lot of people feel lonely at different stages in their lives or some of the time. And that's probably because all of our lives are different. And essentially, we're the only ones who can know our own journey, if I can use that horrible overused word.
Yeah. And you know, it's really interesting. And I think it's well put in one of the chapters here. She did to me what her brother did to her and what his father did to him. Mm. And that really is about the fact that Mona, who you at the outset of this interview, you talked about how Mona was so mean to the priest and kind of controlled him and took the money and basically made him feel like nothing.
Yeah.
But she did that because she had been traumatized herself.
Yeah. And everybody is so hurt and trying to break out of a cycle, but they just don't seem to manage it that well in the end. Mm. But everybody at the same time is making an effort. And I think that's life, isn't it?
It's
just
certainly
trying
is.
To be better than what's gone before.
Do you think that you had a magical childhood growing up in the country?
Oh, well, I did. Yeah, I was certainly privileged in the sense that I had so much freedom and there was all of the things that come with growing up in the country, like collecting conkers and hazelnuts and building rafts on the river and coming
Enid Blyton type.
Not Enid Blyton type. I absolutely loved Enid Blyton growing up, but we had so little Irish literature. I really do remember reading Under the Hawthorn Tree in school and being blown away, because before that it was all Enid Blyton and Roald Dahl.
Yeah, that's true.
And Judy Blume, which I absolutely loved. But it gives you this kind of false idea that literature is something that represents a language that I don't speak and that the people around me don't speak, and that that's what good literature is. But when you come when later in life, when I came to writers like Edna O'Brien and John McGahern and Sean O'Casey, and it was just blew my mind because I saw myself represented in their language and their stories. And Irish writers just appeal to me on a much deeper level for that reason, because they're so relatable.
Author Orla Mackey on The Oliver Callan Show with Maura Duran this morning. A new consular travel campaign has been launched aimed at young adults staying safe abroad during the summer. And Fiona Penneler, Director General of Consular and Citizen Services at the Department of Foreign Affairs, joined Claire Byrne with the details.
Hey, good morning, Fiona.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. So why was it felt necessary to launch this travel campaign?
So last week, the Thánaiste launched our annual summer campaign. And this year, we're, as you say, we're focusing on the younger cohort, those travelling, perhaps finishing exams, travelling for the first time. And it's really just, I suppose, to have those clear messages that apply not just to them, but to all of us, but really to hone in on them and to make sure that they have an amazing time on their holidays, but that they look after each other, look after their friends, and when they come home, that they really have made those right memories. Perhaps not coming home to discovering antibiotics, but at least coming home to making sure that they have, you know, the stories they can tell for many years and a wonderful time.
OK, so you want to sort of arm them before they go to be safe while they're there, and you're giving them lots of tips to do that. So you might just run through some of the practical tips that you would like people to know about.
Absolutely. And it is all about practical. And one of the most basic, that it seems a very basic thing, is make sure your phone is charged. And of course, when we're at home, we have our routine. I charge my phone every night and make sure it's there. But when you're on holidays, routine luckily goes out the window. But it does mean that we're so dependent on our phones that if our phones aren't charged, we can really land ourselves in quite a bit of trouble. I would also say to people, when you're travelling with your friends, make sure you share your location, so that if you do get separated or you just wander down and something happens and you're a little bit confused, maybe it's your first night and you can't remember where your hotel is. We've all been that soldier. Just to make sure that you have your location shared so you can get in touch with your friends, you can hook back up together and stay together and mind each other.
And it's safe to do that, is it? Because some people might be worried about security if they have their live location on their phone.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a balance, absolutely, between what is going on in your wider world. But I think location sharing with friends is something that I know I have seen teenagers do and makes a lot of sense. But you don't necessarily share it with the wider group. But it means those you're on holidays with, you can actually share your location.
Yeah.
As I say, knowing your hotel address.
I was just going to mention that because you said, you know, you might forget where you're staying. That can really easily happen to anybody, drink or no drink involved.
100%.
So when you arrive, you're saying take a picture of it.
Exactly. Take a picture of your hotel. Make sure you have the address somewhere, as I say, on the phone. assuming that you've managed to not lose your phone as a culprit of phone loss, I absolutely hold my hand up. Sometimes, yeah, it's good to have it on a little bit piece of paper.
Yeah.
Another thing that's good to have a photo of is your ID, so your passport. I would also recommend people to have a passport card if they're travelling in Europe. So it means you can leave your passport book in your hotel and just have your card for ID. I think that that really is a good backup plan, just to have the two options. But it's really about those simple practical is really what we're talking about.
Yeah. Now, if someone does find themselves in a situation where they need help while they're abroad, will you talk us through what the Department of Foreign Affairs can do to help, or the types of calls that you get for assistance?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have laid out in our consular assistance charter exactly what we can do and what we can't. And that's on ireland.ie if anyone wants to look it up. But I suppose in a nutshell, what we can do is we can offer practical advice. We can offer assistance. We can ensure that people get a temporary travel document. I mentioned the passport there. So they can get a temporary travel document to go home. If they are unfortunately in need of legal advice, we can put them in touch or advise them of, you know, the local arrangements. We can't get involved in legal cases. Again, we can direct them to a local hospital if they have a medical need, but we can't provide funding for medical assistance. So there's, you know, we will.
So it's directional.
Very much so. Practical advice and knowledge from being on the ground. Mm-hmm. So people who have the experience of being there can say, well, actually, these are the customs and practices here. But you know, it's a teamwork. It's a partnership between us and the citizen. So again, I would say to people, a really important thing to do is make sure you have your travel insurance. That, you know, it's a really strong, and I know the Taoiseach last week was really, you know, being very strong on that message. And, you know, people can say, well, I can't afford the travel insurance. Personally, I would say to people, if you can't afford the travel insurance, I wouldn't be going on the holiday.
It's that important.
It really is. Hopefully you never need it. That's what we want, that it's never used. But if, you know, it does happen, and in a limited number of cases, it will happen, at least you have it there.
Mm-hmm. And what about your European medical card then? I mean, that's a job that I think people know that they should do, but don't always get round to.
Exactly. It's one of those, it's on the list, and I will get round to it, and then you're gone on holidays. And exactly, that is even, it's a complement to the travel insurance, and it means that you can access the public health system across Europe. It is amazing. It's an amazing advantage we have being able to do that. And it is very simple to do. It is one of those admin jobs that can seem a little bit of hassle, but so worth it. So again, definitely encourage people to do that before they go on holidays.
And do you find then that the calls for assistance have increased in recent years?
Yes, absolutely. Now, of course, in a way, it's hard to compare annual, given that with COVID and the pandemic, there was such a gap. But, you know, last year we had about 2,000 calls for assistance, and we had more calls sometimes from people, you know, worried about their family member, can't get in contact with them, etc. But we had about 2,000 cases that we dealt with last year, and that's a considerable increase. Already this year, we're about 11% up on that from last year. So one would assume that the rest of the year will pan out the same, if not more.
And is that in the main younger people? Is that why you've targeted this campaign?
Honestly, no, it's across the broad spectrum of people. You really can't narrow down to one type of person. Or it is good, though, I think, that we get the message out to young people, because, as I say, it is the same message for everyone, but it's just maybe looking at it in a slightly different way. And that's why we've done a targeted campaign this year.
Yeah. And, you know, for the worried parents who are listening to this, if they take all of these steps with their child before they go off on the Leaving Cert holiday, it might help with the worries and the lying awake at night and all of that.
Absolutely. I know they have to get through tomorrow and the next 2 weeks, so they can do that first. And then absolutely. No, definitely. And look, we as a department are there. We're here at home. We've an amazing team at home. We've abroad, all around the world. We have the embassy. We have the consulates. We are there to help and have that partnership and teamwork with the families and with the people. But hopefully you never need to contact us. That's what we want. You have a brilliant holiday. You stick together. You mind each other, and you come home and you're talking about it for years.
Yeah, that's what you want. But when things
go
wrong, you're saying that you're there. Now, on this programme, Colin and Ethna Bell were on recently, founders of the Kevin Bell Repatriation Trust, an organisation that people will be familiar with. And they were talking about some of the work that they do. Now, they obviously work closely with yourselves, I'm sure, don't they?
Absolutely. They are an amazing organisation, an amazing family, and such a a tribute to their son, Kevin, who was the life and soul of the party and who unfortunately passed away. But they have managed now to keep his memory alive. He always said he was going to be famous. Well, he absolutely is. We have worked with them to repatriate over 1,800 people. They do amazing support, amazing work. Yeah, we're really privileged to have a partnership with them.
And so you work with them. Do you use their expertise or how does that relationship work?
Absolutely. So we advise people, I suppose, to in direct contact. But we're in, you know, almost daily contact, at least weekly contact with the organisation. And they have built up over the last 10 years such an expertise in the area of repatriation. And when, you know, the worst happens and someone unfortunately passes away, it is an absolute challenge for people mentally and emotionally to be dealing with that, and to have such an amazing, caring organisation to be able to work with them and bring them home. It's a real privilege to have them as part of the
Now, when people have incidents that involve mental health problems abroad, are you increasingly involved in those cases?
Yes, absolutely. Now, you know, I was having this conversation only with someone the other day, and you wonder, is it that people are now more open about saying, actually, I seem to be in a bad place? Previously, would they have been in the same place and maybe classed it as something else? I've had too much to drink, or I don't know. But definitely there's been quite an increase in mental health cases presenting to us. And it's something that we as a department are, again, interacting with other organisations to upskill ourselves, to make sure that we can give the best care to people. I think it's about a 50% increase over the last number of years in people presenting with acknowledging the mental health cases. But as I say, I'm not sure if it's a positive societal change that people are in a position to have those conversations.
But you need to find ways to upskill your staff so that you know what direction you're sending them in and you're confident that you're doing the right thing.
Absolutely. And we're always trying to be on top of exactly what's happening so we can give the best advice to people, because that it is. It's about the practical advice. It's about the setting the guidelines of the area and what's happening, you know, the local customs, local practices, those kind of things. Another thing that we have noticed as well sometimes can be a challenge is people forgetting medication. And, it, you know, it's one of those, oh, yes, I know I'll pack it, but actually maybe on the rushed morning. And then that can, not necessarily just in mental health cases, but across the board.
All sorts of medical conditions.
Absolutely, it can cause people problems. So it's another one of that on the list. Absolutely, when you're, you know, preparing to go, it's that practical. Make sure you do have that medication with you.
OK, so for all of the worried mammies and daddies now, what's the website address where they can go for the checklist?
So if you go to ireland.ie/travelwise. But I would say to all the worried mammies and daddies, and I'm, you know, with children in secondary school, I'm almost one of them. It's a very small percentage of cases. It's just making sure that people are prepared, using a bit of common sense, practical, but they will have an amazing time. They'll have brilliant holidays and have those great memories. Mm,
but you want them just to put all of those steps in place before they go. And there's a lot of peace of mind that comes with that, Fiona, wouldn't you say?
100%. Have the travel insurance, have the European health card, have your extra phone charger. To the young people, ring your mammy or daddy just every now and then.
Text.
Yes, just say you're okay, because, you know, it is, everyone cares about you, and it's that we're a collective. We all work together. So it's really important that we all do look after each other.
I'm thinking about your consular staff around the world who are dealing with these calls. I mean, you're dealing with people who, they're not going to ring the Irish consular assistance line unless they're really distressed and something awful has happened to them. So it must be difficult work. Is it?
Absolutely. It's a real privilege for us. As I say, we've an amazing team here at home and in all the embassies and consulates around the world. And it's a real privilege that people do come to us in that time of need. But that privilege brings the pressure of really making sure that we can look after them and give them the best service possible. So it absolutely is not an easy job, but it's a really rewarding job. And it means that we are conscious that we are actually affecting people's lives in a positive manner and being able to assist them probably when they're at one of their lowest points. Mm-hmm. So, as I say, it's a real honour and privilege, but it isn't easy.
And do people expect that you can do more than you actually can? I mean, going back to what you said about, you know, providing direction but not intervening.
Yeah, I think if people haven't maybe had a look at our website or look at the charter, one can assume many things. So that's why it's great for people to be clear on what we can and we can't do. And these are international norms, international rules about, you know, when foreign governments can intervene, etc. So we're following that, but we want to help people as much as we can within the framework of what we can do.
Fiona Penelar, Director General of Consular and Citizen Services at the Department of Foreign Affairs, on Today with Claire Byrne. Dubliner Sarah O'Connor is the star of Wicked. It's coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre next month. And she told Maura Duran how she landed the role.
Well, I mean, obviously you have your agent, so you go through a whole audition process. But it's not actually the first time I've auditioned. It took a few times for the timing to be completely correct. But yeah, just a lot of auditions, a lot of work with the team, and just kind of good timing, I think, as
good
well.
Good timing. Tell us about the show Wicked, because yeah. I know it's been seen by over 65 million people worldwide now. Gosh. So how does a young Irish girl land a role in the UK?
I mean, it's a tough world over there. It absolutely is. It is definitely quite a thick skin you need, but it's just fantastic. I mean, to be doing something of this scale coming from a small town always is quite incredible, you know, and you kind of tend to forget about it. But for it to be bringing me home is absolutely amazing. I mean, it's such a big production to be a part of as well. Do you know what I mean? So I think it feels like a big scale show. And when you're in those kind of shows, it is a lot of pressure. But it is fantastic and I absolutely love it. It's just weirdly my way of life though now. I'm very lucky to be able to say that. So yeah, it's fantastic.
You play Glenda. Remind us, just for people listening who haven't seen Wicked, remind us, it's about witches, but tell us about the plot.
Yes, so it's about the two witches, Elphaba and Glinda. They meet in university. Now we know them through the film Wizard of Oz. It's the good witch and the bad witch, I say in inverted commas.
Which one are you?
I am the good witch. So I'm the witch that arrives in the bubble casually. So yes, and then you have the green witch, who is Elphaba, played by Laura Pick, who is absolutely wonderful. And basically it's about their story meeting at university and how people begin to perceive them as good or bad and how the story kind of develops from there. So
now you go to London, you're in a Dublin's West Side Performing Arts School, and then you become the leading lady. But it didn't happen straight away, because I know you went for this play before. Tell us the kind of how you get up to that level in London. As you said, it's a rough and tumble place, especially on the West End.
Oh gosh, it is so competitive. I think you have to have the right teams around you as well, regarding your agent and having the right training. I went to train over in Essex just after leaving cert, so I did 3 years out in Essex and I trained and worked really hard. But I think between actually doing the Fame show over here in RTE many moons ago now.
Yes, that's right.
I know, yeah. So between that and then just my training, you know, I was able to get my foot in the door. My first audition was Mamma Mia West End and I got it. And I think getting a West End as your first job is actually quite a catapult that way. So there's talent obviously always going to be included, but a lot of it is to do with timing and luck and the puzzle pieces.
Yeah, I think that's true with probably most things in life. I know it's such an old Irish saying, what's for you won't pass you. And maybe first time you went for it, maybe you weren't ready.
No, oh, absolutely. And I was in for the other witch. And I said to them, I was like, guys, I'm the other one.
I'm a good person. Right. I'm not a baddie. I ain't no baddie.
It's like, I don't need to fly that way.
Oh my gosh.
But no, absolutely. No, it was the perfect timing and the team were spot on. And they know what they're doing. They've been casting this for 20 years and they know everything about this musical. And they still treat it so freshly. Like when we were learning the musical, they're fresh eyes with the new cast. And it's been an absolute joy to learn from them and to be able to tell the story. It still feels brand new, even running in the show now, you know.
That's brilliant.
It's incredible.
Now, our studio here is filled with your people,
yes,
your peeps.
My ladies.
Your ladies,
hey,
are
ladies
out there. Hi, guys. there are about 100 people in the whole team.
Yeah, there's 90 odd of us touring. So it is very much a tour family. It's a way of life being together, you know. It takes a lot of people to get the 30 odd people on stage every night. And for all the magic that happens and the storytelling, the costumes, the wigs, like there's no detail that hasn't been thought about and there's no kind of, and nothing's been left unturned, you know, all the details of the show. But that's why it's so, iconic.
And what
it's
about
just so
the
relevant
music and the dance and the whole lot? I mean, when did you start doing all that as a little kid?
Yeah, I think I joined West Side at about 7 or 8. So I think I just kind of loved it, you know, did it once a week, twice a week. And then I kind of found a love and noticed there was a talent there along with kind of family. And I was training at the Academy with Virginia Kerr classically as well. So I kind of was dipping in and out of loads of different places. And then they all helped me kind of audition. And then I went to London with my dad for a few spots and then we're like, right, where am I going to go? And then I just never went back. That was 16 years ago almost.
God, it's
amazing.
I've
been so lucky, the work I've done. Like, it's been incredible.
You know? So you kind of really, when you look at this show now, this can run and run and run. I mean, would you like this to continue? Do you feel this is your role now? Have you kind of become Glenda yourself?
Oh, I mean, when you're doing a role so many times a week, there is parts of you that tend to overlap and it does become a bit blurry from time to time, hence why I'm wearing a sequins top.
Even on the radio, yeah. I'm into this. Seriously, this is the way to be. Makeup, but, tops, the whole lot.
Yeah, but absolutely. I mean, I'm contracted till January and I'll absolutely be throwing myself into it till then. But after that, I mean, as an actor, you never think too far ahead. But I'm just going to enjoy it in the moment for now and we'll see. But Wicked's been in my life for a very long time, so it will always be in it to some capacity, you know.
I believe your dad brought you to a production of Wicked when you were 14. Was that in the States?
That was near the beginning of the original. Yeah.
Wow.
So it was absolutely incredible. And I think we then went to the big music store back then. I don't know if it's still there, where you went and bought the music book and you got the CD. And I have played that CD to death. I could do all of the parts, like Dr. Dillamond. I could do the Monkees. I could do all of it.
What's your favourite track then?
Oh, it changes. Currently, it would be For Good, the duet I do with Laura. Which is one of the songs in Act Two. It's very, very special. But acting wise, I do really enjoy Thank Goodness, which is the top of Act Two as well.
Brilliant, yeah. Listen. So when people go in now to the Bord Gáis Theatre, when are you starting? It's the end of this month, is it 20?
It's actually in July.
Oh, it's 23rd
of July.
Oh, I thought it was the 23rd of July.
23rd of July, yeah.
Brilliant. So when I'm sitting in the audience now, what do I see as the curtains lift?
Oh, listen, your eyes won't know where to go. It's so spectacular. The set design is incredible and what they managed to tour is pretty much the exact same as London. So there's been no expense spared at all. It brings you in and out, even though it's one set, it brings you in and out of the different parts of Oz as well. The university, you have the bedrooms that the girls stay in where I have my big popular number. And then, you know, obviously all of the magic happens when people are flying and it just kind of transports you even the Alibic Road. And I mean, it's never
some
ending.
Nostalgia meets modern.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's unbelievable. And then you get to the Emerald City, which I mean, is obviously the most iconic part of it. And you get to meet all the incredible people that work and live in the Emerald City. And that's when our transformation begins as well. And we meet the wizard and it all goes
from
there.
I've never seen it, but I really want to go now. It must take a long time to get ready every night, hair, makeup, the whole lot.
We've got it all down now. I do my makeup at the same time that someone's doing my wigs because, oh my God, our wigs are incredible. Laura takes longer. I mean, she has to get green.
Yeah.
But I think they've got it to about 40 minutes now. But yeah, we do get in.
That's pit stop stuff.
Oh God, like they're so good. It's fantastic. But yeah, I mean, I'm in early anyway just to kind of see everyone, warm up, get the body going, eat well and have a cup of tea and a natter with my friends before we get on stage, you know.
And then prep in the sense of your voice and all that. Do you have to take loads of vitamins, hydrate, the whole lot?
Oh, you should see. It's like a pharmacy in my house. It's the vitamins, powder form, tablets, you know, coffee. A lot of water. But I have a really good vocal specialist that I work with and I started working with him months before the gig even started.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's your vocal technique and vocal health is the most important thing. And also just staying fit in body as well. You know, go to the gym and...
So what do you have to do? Oh, all that kind of stuff.
That's exactly what I said. That's exactly... No.
Just do one vocal thing, please.
There you go. A little bit. God, guys, what time is it? No, thanks. I'm not doing a show at 5 to 10.
Listen.
Sarah O'Connor, star of Wicked, chatting to Maura Duran, who's in for Oliver Callan all this week. With the Olympics and the Euros just around the corner, Claire Byrne was chatting about the best and worst national anthems. And who better to take her through than George Hamilton, host of the Hamilton Tapes on Lyric FM and RTE's chief commentator on many World Cups, Euros and Olympic Games.
Boring to you, Claire.
Lovely to have you back us on the programme. So we'll start with that opening match. Germany's anthem is synonymous with the tournament. They featured at every single Euro, haven't they, since 1972?
That's correct, yeah. It'll be their 14th time at the championship, 5 times as the old Federal Republic and now the 9th as a united Germany. Their anthem is actually music composed by Franz Josef Haydn, the classical composer. He'd been commissioned to compose an anthem in honour of the Habsburg Emperor. Halte Franz der Kaiser, God save Francis the Emperor. And it was performed in Vienna in 1797 when the monarch was attending an evening of opera and ballet to celebrate his 29th birthday. They heard the music in Germany and they fancied that they could use it too, because Germany at the time was a disparate, it wasn't even an entity, it was a 38, 39 different states. And they thought they could put it together and turn it into something that would unite Germans. Deutschland über alles. And that's where that phrase came from. Not the way it was picked up by the Nazis later, but it was an attempt to try and get Germans to come together in one unified Germany. And you know, funny thing is, back in 2006, when Germany hosted the World Cup, the Bild newspaper, the tabloid, in a very partisan way of getting Germans to get behind their team, they printed the words of the national anthem every day the team was playing. I wonder if they do that the same time this time.
Let's have a blast of it, George. Now, that's the German anthem. Let's move on then to Flower of Scotland. It's significant in that it doesn't feature very often at tournaments. Let's hear it. So, George, there is no agreed national anthem of Scotland. That's why this is controversial, right?
Yeah, it actually dates only from the 1960s. It's a modern enough song. It was sung by a folk group, the Corries, and it became an anthem for the Scottish rugby team when Billy Steele, a winger who was on tour with the British and Irish Lions in South Africa, that famous tour of 1974, he encouraged his Scottish teammates to sing it, and it kind of became the pre-game anthem. But that only dates from the Five Nations in 1990. So it's all rather new. And as you say, there is no Scottish anthem, but Scottish fans, rugby to begin with and taken up by the football fans, and now sing it with gusto, and it is their unofficial anthem.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this will be the first Euros where we'll have God Save the King.
Yes, that's very true too. It's funny, if Liechtenstein had been in the Euros, which is highly unlikely, but if they ever had, even though they drew 1-0 with Ireland on one infamous occasion, but they never come near qualifying, but if they did, you'd hear God Save the King twice because their anthem with different words is the same melody. Kind of funny that.
Let's have a little blast now of the next one. This is the Danish national anthem. Very beautiful. Translates to there is a lovely country.
Oh, well, it is a lovely country too, even if somewhat expensive. Do you know something? Denmark, that's one of two Danish national anthems. It's one of only two countries in the world that has two national anthems. New Zealand's the other one. Why they have two? Well, there's a monarchy in Denmark, so there's a royal anthem for anything that the monarch is involved in. And then there's a civil anthem, which they play if the monarch isn't there. So it's unique in that way that it's one of a pair.
And no, there's no argument about that. Nobody minds that there are two.
Oh, no, not at all. No, mm-hmm. It's just part of the way the thing had developed over the years that Denmark got itself a second album. Second anthem for the specific reasons of the country itself.
That difficult second anthem, eh, George? Now, let's move to the only instrumental in the bunch. This is Spain's national anthem, the Marcha Real. That's another one that you have to sit up a little straighter for, right?
You do indeed.
RTE's George Hamilton on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.